Genesis chapter 14, let's read this. We'll launch into this morning's message. Genesis 14. In the days of Amraphel, king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elasar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goyim, these kings made war with Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinab, king of Admah, Shemeber, king of Zeboiim, and the king of Bela, that is, Zoar. All these joined forces in the valley of Siddim, that is, the Salt Sea. 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, and in the 13th year they rebelled. In the 14th year, Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him came and defeated the Rephaim in Ashtaroth-Karnaim, the Zuzim in Ham, the Emim in Shava-Kiriathim, and the Horites in their hill country of Seir, as far as El Paran on the border of the wilderness. Then they turned back and came to En-Mishpat, that is Kadesh, and defeated all the country of the Amalekites and also the Amorites, who were dwelling in Hazazon Tamar. When the king of Sodom, the king of Gomorrah, the king of Admah, the king of Zeboiim, the king of Bela, that is Zoar, went out, and they joined battle in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goyim, Amraphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, 4 kings against 5. Now the valley of Siddim was full of bitumen pits, and as the kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled, some fell into them. The rest fled to the hill country. So the enemy took all the possessions of Sodom and Gomorrah, and all their provisions, and went their way. They also took Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was dwelling in Sodom, and his possessions, and went their way. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were the allies of Abram. When Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his trained men, born in his house, 318 of them, and went in pursuit as far as Dan. He divided his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and defeated them and pursued them to Hobah, north of Damascus. Then he brought back all the possessions and also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, and the women and the people. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him at the valley of Shava, that is, the king's valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth. Blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." Abram gave him a tenth of everything, and the king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the persons, but take the goods for yourself." Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I've lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, that I would not take a thread or a sandal strap or anything that is yours, lest you should say, 'I have made Abram rich.' I will take nothing but what the young man have eaten and the share of the men who went with me. Let Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre take their share." After these things, the word of the Lord came to Abram in a vision. "Fear not, Abram. I am your shield. Your reward shall be very great." Well, as we look at the life of Abram, we've seen that in chapter 13, he made a bad decision. He goes off down to Egypt. Chapter 12. He goes down into Egypt because of a famine. Famine came, and Abram makes up his mind. Here's what he's got to do, and he runs down to Egypt. And then in chapter 13, we see that a different side of Abram. He's no longer nervous and having to take control of things for himself, and he recognizes that there's tension between him and his nephew Lot. And so he sits back, and though God had promised him a land, he tells Lot, "You choose which part of the land that you want, and I'll take whatever's left over." And God tells Abram, "It doesn't matter which part Lot took, I'm giving all of it to you." You know, sometimes as we go through the Christian life, it's difficult for us to distinguish, when am I supposed to wait and do nothing, and when am I supposed to wait and do something? Those two things, they are so contrary to each other. The whole point is to wait. But is this supposed to be an active wait, or is this supposed to be a passive wait? Sometimes waiting actively can get us in trouble. I remember when I was working for one contractor, we had a big building, kind of a pole barn, and we were taking it and we were converting it into office space. And so it was myself, I was young at the time, and I had a younger guy working with me. And it was about a half hour, 45 minutes till the boss was going to show up for lunch break. And we got everything done that he had wanted us to get done for the morning. There were about five or six doorways that we had to frame in. We were going to do that after lunch. And I said, you know what, let's go ahead and frame those in. But I wasn't quite sure about one number. And we framed everything in. We're just finishing the last nail as the guy pulls in the driveway. And he looks around. He said, man, this is great. This is really impressive. In fact, you even got more done than what I was planning on. And he takes out his tape measure and measures it. And I stuck every doorway in there an inch too low. And so my act of waiting turned out to be an hour of repair when we got back from lunch, knocking out all the studs and lifting everything another inch. Sometimes waiting actively can get us in trouble. But sometimes waiting passively can get us in trouble. I was down in southern Minnesota, and it's very flat down south in Minnesota, and the winters, you get at least this much snow. It's cold. It's cold snow, so it's very light, and it blows with the wind. And this was just a regular old-fashioned blizzard. Don't see a lot of those, but this was a regular old-fashioned blizzard. My brother was with me. We were staying in my grandparents' house. My father-in-law-to-be had just given me a car for a dollar, and I think that was more than it was worth. You couldn't even shut the, you could stick your fingers out through it when you shut the door. But so we had this wonderful buy of a vehicle, and we're living by ourselves, two young men. Nobody's looking over our shoulders telling us we can't. So we decided to go drive around in the middle of the blizzard. The thing had front wheel drive, so we thought it would be a good idea. It wasn't, but we thought it would be. So we get out into the country. And there's all these little groves, and wherever there's a grove, the wind can't blow. So there's no snow across the road. You get just past the grove, and then you'd hit about a foot drift, and you plow through it, and you get all these waves of snow, and it was kind of fun. And so we went 5 miles out in the country, and my brother says, "Hey, let me drive." Okay, so we get out at a intersection. There's nobody coming. Nobody's stupid enough to drive out in something like that, except us. And so we change drivers, and we start going. And I said, "Now, just be careful not to." He says, "Where do I turn, right?" "No, not here. You don't turn here. There's no road right there. That's a ditch." It just looks like there's a road there because that's where all the snow is. And so it was after a Wednesday night service. We both had these little flannel shirts on. We both had nice church shoes on. We were idiots. We went out with nothing. And so we're sitting there in the ditch. That is not a time to wait passively for help to come. That's when you get out of the car, you go up to the nearest farmhouse, you knock on the door, and they open the door and stare with you with four eyes. "What do you want? What are you doing out in a storm like this?" There's times to wait actively. There's times to wait passively. And the proposition this morning is simply this, that as those who've been promised God's blessing, as strangers and pilgrims walking through this world, we must await God's blessing while being actively engaged. You know, God hasn't made it so that when we get saved, now we've got that taken care of, our fire insurance is in place, and now I'm just waiting till I die, or now I'm just waiting for the Lord to come. When he saved us because he's got work for us to do. He's got something for us to accomplish. He's leaving us here on planet Earth because he actually wants us to accomplish something between the time that he saved us and the time that he calls us home, either by death or to glory with Jesus Christ. So while we wait, we need to wait actively. This text gives us three examples of what active engagement looks like in the life of a believer. Now, these aren't the only ways to be actively engaged as we await God to fulfill the promise of his blessing. But these are three Three ways that can apply to us of actively engaging as we wait for God to fulfill His promises to us. When we left Genesis 13, God had just promised to Abram the land. And Abram sets up his tent by the oaks of Mamre, and he sets up an altar, and he starts to worship God, and he's waiting. He's waiting for God to fulfill the promise. Give me a land. In fact, he says, I'm going to give you your descendants. They'll number as the sands of the sea. And so Abram's waiting, but he's waiting actively as he waits. What does active engagement look like while we wait for God's blessing? We come to this text. Active engagement looks like cultivating strategic relationships. Look down at verse 13. We're familiar with the story that just took place. There's a conflict between nations. Then one who had escaped came and told Abram the Hebrew, who was living by the oaks of Mamre, the Amorite, brother of Eshcol and of Aner. These were allies of Abram. As Abram chose a place in which to live by the oaks of Mamre. Mamre was a man. He had a couple brothers. We're introduced to them in this text. We find that God had directed him to a place where God wanted him to build relationships with some people. These relationships were divinely ordered by God. When God had called Moses out of Mesopotamia and said, go to the land that I'll show you, God knew that at some point in his life, he was going to direct Abram to a man called Mamre, to a man called Aner, to a man called Eshcol. And so he knew all of that when he called Abram away from all the friends that he had in Mesopotamia. And so he directs him into the promised land. And not only did he direct him to this place, but there was divine work when Lot says, you know what, I want this for myself. I want the best for myself. God could have worked it so that he sent Abram down that direction. But God orchestrated it all by directing Abram up a different direction. And so he did. So as he comes to this place, it came about as the result of Lot's choice to take the land to the east, and it came about as the result of Abram's choice to dwell near Hebron. All of this seems like it's totally man choosing, just kind of randomly. But as we're learning through the book of Genesis, even man's choices aren't random. Man works out the will of God, choosing, sometimes blocking those choices, and God is directing him at this point to three men that Abram builds a relationship. It's a divinely ordered relationship, and these relationships were developed over time. When we saw what, back in chapter 13, verse 18, Abram moves his tent, and he came and he settled by these oaks. The word there is to sit down. It's to establish oneself. It's to wait is the idea. So Abram comes to this place and he says, you know what? Rather than moving all over the place again with all of my herds and all of my family and all of my tents, this is where we're going to spend some time. And he settles there. In chapter 14, verse 13, verse that we just read, it says that he was living there. The idea there is to settle down, to abide, or to set up a place so that you can establish a dwelling for a period of time. These relationships were divinely ordained, and they were established over time. These relationships were mutually advantageous. We see this in chapter 14, verse 13, by two words. It says that they were allies of Abram. Actually, there's two words there in the Hebrew where our English just says one. They were allies. The idea is that they were partners in community. That is, because they lived in the same proximity, their interests were linked to one another. The next term is the term that we're familiar with. Berit has to the idea of a covenant. They were partners by proximity, but they were also partners by covenant. And so it speaks to their mutual commitment despite their individual interests. And so they had made a covenant together that if one attacks you, all of us are attacked. If one attacks me, you're going to come to my aid in all of this. And both of these aspects are threatened by what we find here in this chapter. Their community partnership is challenged by an international invasion, and their personal loyalties are challenged. That covenant loyalty is challenged because Abram's kin is captured. So these relationships are divinely ordained. They're developed over time. They're mutually beneficial, and they're strengthened when they're threatened. You know what? Neither of these men, Abram nor Mamre or his two brothers, were immediately threatened by the international conflict that takes place. Only the surrounding communities were threatened. I was going to have a map up here. I didn't get it up in time. I'm sorry. If you can picture the Sea of Galilee and the Dead Sea down here, what happens is we've got some kings coming from Mesopotamia. They come over the north through that Fertile Crescent. They come down and they sweep down on the east side of the Jordan River. They come down below the Dead Sea, and they swing around here, and they come back, and they capture Sodom and Gomorrah right down about the base of the Dead Sea. Then they start to move north. Abram is living just off to the west of that. But as this international conflict comes, these kings from a foreign land, they're coming, they're sweeping through. The Bible tells us that the people that they swept through and started to take over were ones that they'd already conquered. In fact, they'd been in service to them for the past 12 years. In the 13th year, they rebelled. Basically, they refused to pay taxes without proper representation. They just said, no, you can't. We're not going to give you the taxes that we've been giving to you for the last 12 years. And these guys don't like that, so they come to collect back payment on their taxes. This conflict is on an international scale. It's the first recorded military conflict that we have in Scripture. It's the kings of Mesopotamia against the kings of southern Canaan. It's a normal conflict. But neither Abram nor Mamre were immediately affected by this conflict. But both were personally affected by this conflict because Abram's nephew Lot is plundered and abducted. So Abram's loyalties are proved at this point. Abram is living in the promised land over here. Where did Abram come from? He came from Mesopotamia, didn't he? So all of a sudden, he's got some good old homeboys coming and sweeping through the promised land. Who does he side with? Old friends or new neighbors? He sides with his new neighbors, doesn't he? Wouldn't there be just a little bit of a challenge for him to side with his old friends from Mesopotamia? But Abram proves his loyalties as he sides with his new friends. But as we come to verse 13, we see that Abram has made all of these relationships. Relationships that have been divinely ordained. They've been developed over time. They've benefited each other mutually, and they've worked closely in proximity. They're strengthened when they're threatened. But these relationships maintain a distinction. Look at what the Bible says in verse 13. Then one who had escaped from this conflict came and told Abram the what? Abram the Hebrew. This little phrase here reminds us that for all of his loyalties, for all of his proximity, Abram was dwelling among them, but Abram at this time is not considered one of them. And Jesus says the same thing about us as Christians as he's praying just before he goes to the cross. He says, Father, the world has hated them because they are not of this world, just like I'm not of this world. But I don't ask that you would take them out of this world, only that you would keep them from the evil one. We understand that we're in the world, but not of the world. You know, I think as we look at the life of Abram, one way that he actively engages in the world while not being of the world is by engaging in strategic relationships. Think about what God has done in your life. Who are those people that surround you? That you have contact with, that you have opportunity to touch their lives, and they have the opportunity to touch your lives. May or may not be Christians. But God has used the choices of yourself and others to put you up against each other for a time. What are you doing with those relationships? In that place where you live with your next door neighbor? In that cubicle over as you sit in the office? The person that you happen to bump into every workday down at Wawa? What are these relationships? Are they just faces that you're becoming familiar with? Or are they people that you're beginning to think about as people? Are they people that you're realizing are working and living and dying with an eternity at stake just like you? You know, Abram realized as he's living in this world, but not of this world, that people aren't pawns. He can't just use them. He's dependent on them. And just by being with them, his, not destiny, but his welfare is tied in with theirs. And so as we come as Christians in this world, there's a temptation for us as Christians to withdraw from the world, to be isolated, to be secluded, to shut out everybody other than ourselves, so that we don't become tainted by the world. That's the wrong attitude for us to take. Now, we see that Abram is different from Lot. Now, had Lot chosen the west, Abram would have gone to the east. But Abram maintains his distinction. Abram the Hebrew. Did you see what happened with Lot? Verse 12. The bandits come in and they take away Lot, the son of Abram's brother, who was, what's the words there? He was dwelling in Sodom and his possessions, and they went their way. Well, when the band of marauders comes through Sodom, what's there to distinguish Lot from any other of the Sodomites? Apparently, not very much. In fact, when it's all said and done, where does Lot go back to? He goes right back to Sodom, doesn't he? And we find out in the New Testament that Lot was, in fact, a righteous man, but Lot was living in the world and looking like he was of the world. But Abram didn't. And so as Abram lives in this world, he establishes strategic relationships, relationships that didn't draw him into the conflict, relationships that kept him above that conflict, and yet he knew that his welfare was tied in with theirs as people. Folks, we've got to, as Christians, remember that yes, our citizenship isn't ultimately down here, but the people that you and I rub shoulders with on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, on a monthly basis, they're people. They're people that have a destiny. They're people that God has put us in contact with together. And it's our responsibility over time to get to know them as people. And Abram does that in this context. One of the ways that we actively engage is by establishing strategic relationships. Another way that we remain actively engaged is by preparing for risky involvement. Verses 14 through 16. We see that when Abram heard that his kinsmen had been taken captive, he led forth his, what does your Bible say there? He led forth his trained men, trained servants, I think is how the King James has it. Any other translations there? Okay, the idea is these are men that are prepared. Prepared for what? What's that? Prepare for battle. I mean, they're going to go in and they're going to do the job rather efficiently. Sometimes I think we don't make a very good impact as Christians because we're not prepared for an involvement that's going to require risk. And this, as Abram sets up his household, he's got 318 men, all of them born in his house, that they're going to be the ones that get to move forward and take advantage of a situation that they didn't ask for, but they were ready for it. You see, Abram was able to get involved because he was prepared to get involved. When this man comes and says, Abram, your nephew Lot has been taken away, Abram doesn't have to think, oh man, I just wasn't ready for this. I've got to get my guys ready. Okay, guys, here's a sword. No, not that hand. Stick it in the other hand. Okay, let's learn to march. Okay, we might need to learn how to ride camels here, guys. Oh, don't fall off the camel, for goodness sake. We're never going to make any headway this way. They're all ready. They're trained. And because they're ready, they can get involved. You ever been in that opportunity where somebody says, you know what? I don't believe there's a God. Say, tell me, why do you believe there's a God? And you go, man, I wish I was ready for that one. That's like a slow pitch, underhand. I wanted to hit that one out of the park. You know what? Sometimes we can't get involved because we're just not ready to get involved. You know why we're not involved? Why we're not ready to get involved? Because we've been worried about trying to get the right channels on our Comcast. We've been worried about updating our status on Facebook. We've been concerned about getting that mortgage down one more point. We've been concerned with, and you can fill in the blank, okay? Why have we not been ready? Because we've been so focused right here, right now. In order for us to be actively engaged properly right here, right now, folks, we've got to be prepared. Because it's not primarily about my comfort, and there's so much available to keep us comfortable. And honest to goodness, I am the person that loves comfort the most, okay? But at some point, we've got to be willing to be uncomfortable. At some point, we've got to step away from the chores that pertain only to our household, and we've got to stick a sword in our hand, and we've got to learn to ride a camel. I mean, we might have to actually memorize some verses from this book. We might actually have to study what theology means and how it's connected. Doctrine. You have to be able to explain the way of salvation to somebody. What does it mean to call upon the name of the Lord and thou shalt be saved? What does that look like? What does that mean? If I just pray a prayer, repeat after me, okay, now I'm saved. Yes? No? What does that look like? Are you ready for those kind of questions? Abram was able to get involved because he was prepared to get involved. And so as he moves forward here, these trained men, they're trained for battle. Abram is able to get involved because he was not afraid of what that involvement would cost. How many men does he take? 318. Wouldn't you like to be that 18th guy? Yes, I got included in the number forever. Yay. They don't round it off. It's a pretty specific number. I think the whole point of this is, hey, folks, this isn't a whole lot of guys. How many? We're talking four kings from Mesopotamia. They sweep through and they beat and defeat five kings of Canaan. Kings come with armies, okay? And these kings down here are kings of cities or city-states. They have armies. Abram, you're going to go against four armies, five armies, with how many men? 318. And 18. Okay. Oh, good. Glad you got that number. Now it might be pitiful. Abram, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? What makes you think that with 318 guys, you can go and do anything on the international scene? How many men did Gideon have? Minus 18. He had 300, okay? He had 300. How many men did David have when he went and retook his sons and his wives? He went with 400 men. You know what? How many men did Jonathan go and defeat the garrison with? One guy. John and one, that's two, all right? And what does Jonathan say at that moment? Numbers don't matter when you have God. So Abram gets involved in the conflict. He's prepared. But he's not just prepared for conflict, he's prepared for the cost. You know what? When I go out and do what God has given to me to do, what God has divinely channeled my direction to accomplish, you know what it's going to look like? It's going to look like more than I can chew. Did I ask? Did I bite this off for myself? No. God brought this to you. Are you prepared? I've been preparing, but are you ready for what it's going to cost? I don't know. What's it going to cost? Well, we see where they go. It says there in verse 14 that they went in pursuit as far as Dan. They're in Hebron, kind of down towards the south in Canaan. They go up to northern Canaan, up to Dan. What they do is over the next probably 2 days, they ride hard, maybe 50 miles a day. They get there 100 miles later, they show up, and they find the guys. So, after they catch up with them, they take a good night's rest and fight the next day, right? Not on your life. Been riding hard for 2 days, now's the time to attack. And so they spend that night splitting up. Verse 15, he divides his forces against them by night, he and his servants, and they defeat them. And then the next day, they ride another 50 miles. Stink. Are you sure we can't just... You ever been so tired that you've actually been sitting up and just falling asleep? You've been so cold, it's the only thing that keeps you awake is the fact that you're freezing to death. You step inside and you're still standing, but you're just ready to go to sleep. Okay. These guys are falling asleep in their saddles. They're so, so tired. But you know what? They're ready for whatever the cost. You know why we don't get involved sometimes? Sometimes we don't get involved because we're not prepared. But sometimes we don't get involved because we just don't want to pay whatever price it's going to cost us. How many like going knocking on doors and witnessing? Okay. Nobody. Nope. I've got one person who likes that. Okay. Most of us don't. Why don't we like going and knocking on doors and witnessing? Okay. Let's take it the stranger out of it. How many like talking to our friend or neighbor that we know about the gospel? Okay. A few of us. Again, in the minority. Why do most of us not like doing that? Because we're chickens. We're afraid. That's the only reason. We're afraid. Afraid of what? We're afraid of what it's going to cost us. If I say something, what's that guy going to think of me? If I do say something, what are they going to do? I mean, maybe it's better for me not to say anything so I don't drive a wedge so that it's for the gospel's sake. I'm not going to say anything. Whew, got out of that one, right? And we dismiss ourselves strategically. We don't get involved sometimes, not just because we're not prepared. We get involved sometimes just because we're not willing to pay the cost. You know, it might mean that I have to give up a Saturday in order to help work with the guys at church. Ugh, that's my Saturday. You know how many things I've got to do at home? You know what I could do with just a Saturday? If I'm not willing to give up a Saturday, what am I willing to give up? That's a real question. Sometimes we don't get involved just because we don't want to consider the cost. But because Abram got involved, he was able to see results. Look at verse 16. Then he brought back all the possessions, and he brought back his kinsmen with Lot and his possessions. He brought back the women and the people. I think up in verse 15 it says, and he defeated them. He defeated them. Now, could Abram have told you with all clarity and surety of mind, I'm going to take my 318 guys and I'm going to defeat four kings who just defeated five kings by themselves? I'm going to do this. So help me God. Was he assured of it? No. But he was willing to do it. He was willing to try it. He ventured out in faith. And he gets involved. He's prepared. He counts the cost. He moves forward. Because he was willing to get involved, Abram saw results. Here's the thing, folks. We can live a safe, comfortable Christian life. That we can avoid the conflicts. We don't have to expend any effort. And we can just remain focusing on the here and now, raising comfortable families that are safe and separated and segregated from anything that would hurt us. But by not getting involved, we don't get to see what God would do if we would. Because Abram was willing to get involved. He was able to see God work in a way that he never would have been able to see him work had he just sat on the sidelines and waited inactively. He defeats them. It's the same word that's used back in verse 5 where it says, these kings struck down the Rephaim, I believe it is in that verse, the giants of the land. But because Abram gets involved, he sees what God can do. Was it too big for Abram? You bet it was. But God did something because Abram was willing to do something with God. Not for God. Sometimes we get that mixed up. I'm going to do this for God. Actually, God could probably do it better without you. Okay? You ever worked with somebody who's been wanting to help, bless their heart, but not much of a help, bless their heart? That's kind of what we are for God. Okay, God could do this so much better without us, but in his grace, he chooses to use us. And because we're willing to be used, God is able to do something that we could never begin to imagine what he would do. A third way to be actively engaged as a believer who's awaiting the blessing looks like discerning spiritual enrichment. What does it look like, the spiritual benefit in my life? I've got to be actively engaged in learning how to discern what is good, what's not good, what is acceptable, what will I allow near, what am I going to shove off to the side. We come down to verses 17 down through chapter 15, verse 1. After Abram returns from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom goes out to meet him at the valley of Shava. That is the king's valley. But not just the king of Sodom, also Melchizedek, king of Salem, brings out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High. And so we have this dichotomy of kings coming out to meet Abram as he's coming back from his victory, the defeat of these kings. And immediately following this exhausting, physical, wearying battle, Abram is confronted with another battle. In fact, this battle is probably even more dangerous than the previous battle. This battle is characterized by the nature of the two kings that are ready to confer their benefits on Abram at this point. The one is the king of Sodom, verse 17. He goes out to meet Abram. He's the prince, he's the king. Back in chapter 13, verse 13, he's the king of the one who are said to be wicked, great sinners, with their fist in the face of God. And you know who their king is? This man. He stands as a satanic type, if you will. The prince of the power of the air. The ruler of this present darkness. The king of Sodom comes out. And what he does when he meets Abram, he barters with him. He says, tell you what, Abram, if you give me the people, you can take all the goods. Doesn't that sound like a pretty reasonable thing? I mean, he just won these spoils. He would be entitled to them, don't you think? But as you look at this, go down to verse 21. The king of Sodom said to Abram, give me the tenth, the persons, but take the goods for yourself. Does he acknowledge anything about Abram helping him? Abram winning the battle for him? There's no gratitude whatsoever, is there? Abram, good to see you. Give me my people, you take the things. Well, wait a minute. In this culture in particular, that would have been a huge dishonor. Just for a second, go back to chapter 12. Go back to chapter 12, verse 3. God had promised this to Abram back in Mesopotamia. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. Whoa, 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 whoa. All of a sudden in this text, we're shown a huge social faux pas where this ingrateful man who's focused only on himself, the very climax, the very zenith and epitome of all selfishness and satiation with pleasure. This prince of darkness, if you will, dishonors Abram, the man who's been given the promise and the blessing. This is ill foreboding for the king of Sodom. He barters with him, if you give this to me, I'll give this to you. You know what? Satan is the same way with us, folks. He comes to us often after a spiritual victory and says, you know what? You deserve to take it easy for a while. Why don't you just take some of the spoils of your victory? And what does that look like? You know what? It looks different in every situation. And so as we try to get prepared for what this looks like, it never looks the same way twice. And so as we've been working, we've been battling, we've been engaged, we've been involved. In fact, God has given us a victory. We've been able to see him work. And all of a sudden, the tempter comes up beside us and say, hey, why don't you compromise just a little bit? And Abram's going to have the right response. But we see that the nature of the king of Sodom is backdropped against the king of Salem. And then we see him there in verse 18. Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out the bread and the wine. And the king of Salem is called priest of God Most High. He's a type of Christ, the book of Hebrews says. Let's go to Hebrews chapter 7. We'll see what Hebrews says about this character, Melchizedek. He's really not heard of again until Psalm chapter 110. And then again in the book of Hebrews. And those are really the only three places that we find this man mentioned. Hebrews chapter 7, verses 1 through 10. The Bible says, this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abram returning from the slaughter of the kings, and he blessed him. And to him, to Melchizedek, Abram apportioned or gave a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, the king of righteousness, Melech, king Zadok, righteousness, Melchizedek, king of righteousness. And then he's also king of Salem, that is, king of Shalom, king of peace. He's without father, without mother, without genealogy. He has no beginning of days in the narrative in the Old Testament. We're not giving any end of his life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Now see how great this man was, Melchizedek, to whom Abraham, the patriarch, gave a tenth of all his spoils. Now those descendants of Levi who received the priestly office have a commandment in the law to take tithes from people, that is, from their brothers, though they're also descendants from Abraham. But this man, who does not have his descent from those received tithes from Abraham and blessed him who had the promises, so it's beyond dispute that the inferior is blessed by the one who's superior. And in the one case, tithes are received by mortal men, but in this case, by him of whom it's testified that he lives. One might even say that Levi himself receives tithes, paid tithes through Abraham, for he was still in the loins of Abraham when Melchizedek met him. All he's saying is, folks, as Abraham, the man of faith, is brought in context with Melchizedek, priest of the Most High God, which one in this story is superior? Melchizedek is the greater personage in this story. He's the king of righteousness, his name means. He's the king of peace. And if the king of Sodom is a type of satanic power and control activity in this world, Melchizedek, the king of righteousness, pictures none other than Jesus Christ. Some would say that he was the pre-incarnate Christ. I don't believe that's so. I believe he was just a man that the Bible references with great impression. But this man is a type of Christ. He honors Abram with a victory celebration. He brings out bread and wine. Bread and wine is used in the Passover. It foretells what will belong to the people when they come into that good land flowing in milk and honey. The bread and the wine speaks of the kingdom blessings. And so as Abraham comes back from defeating outlying kings who've invaded the promised land, Melchizedek comes with the blessings of the land, the blessings of God's kingdom. And he recognizes Abram's victory. And he bestows a blessing on Abram at this point. And he says there in verse 19, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth." This title for God is usually used in international contexts when it talks about God being the God of the nations. It's used here with Melchizedek. It's used in the context with Balaam and Balak, where God's people are preferred, they're chosen, they're elect over other nations, and their God is greater than the gods of other nations. It's used in context with Nebuchadnezzar, where the Most High God awards to whomever he will the kingdoms that are on planet earth, because God is over not just his people, but all kingdoms. He's the Most High God. So this is the name that Melchizedek uses to acknowledge that. Look at verse 20. "Blessed not only be Abraham by God Most High, but blessed be God Most High." Why? "Because he has delivered your enemies into your hand." Abram, you took the risk and you got involved. You were prepared, you were willing to pay the cost, and you were able then to receive the spoils of victory. You know why you did that? Sure do, because I'm a good fighter. No. Because I'm a good witnesser. No. Because I'm a good preacher. No. Because I'm a good dad. Because I'm a good guy. No. Because God was with you. That's why it's so scary, folks. When we get the victory, all of a sudden, we start to think exactly the same way Lucifer did. We see in Ezekiel chapter 28. You know what? That beauty that you possess, that wisdom that belongs to you, you think that all comes from yourself, don't you? You know what? That all comes from God, your Maker, the Most High God. Abraham comes back from a victory, and he has to fight an even bigger battle, a battle that wants to acknowledge his own importance, his own significance, his own rights. But Melchizedek reminds him, "Abraham, you're nothing except for the fact that God has chosen to bless you. And because he's blessed you, you've been able to be involved. You've been able to make a difference." You know what? Each offer demands a decision. So to the king of Salem, Abram gives a tithe, a tenth of everything. To the king of Sodom, Abram says this. Look down in verse 22. Abram says to the king of Sodom, "I've taken a vow. I've lifted my hand to the Lord God Most High, the one who owns all of heaven, every star you can see in the sky, and every field you can see on planet earth. I will not take so much as one thread. I won't even take a sandal strap to hold the sole of my shoe onto my foot while I walk. I'm not going to take anything from you, king of Sodom." Why? Verse 20, end of 23. "So that you can't say that you're the one who made Abram rich." You know what? I like being dependent on God. Have you ever gotten to that place in life? Do you like? How many of us like being dependent? I don't. I like being independent, okay? Oftentimes, I'm an American first before I'm a Christian. I love being independent. God is working in your life and in mine so that we want more than anything else in life to be dependent on the one we're supposed to be dependent on. If there was ever a man who was a warrior, a man's man, it was King David, okay? He was ruddy. He was a man of war. He was a fighter. He says, "I praise God that he's trained my hand for the battle." What psalm do we go to when we're struggling the most? "The Lord is my..." You know what, folks? I'm nothing more than a sheep. And we got to get good with that. Abraham says, "You know what? I am good with that. I don't want the blessings that come from compromise. I want God to be the only one who blesses my life." He's not concerned with being politically correct, but he's even careful about the details in his life. The choices of enrichment today will determine your capacity for enrichment. What are you choosing to enrich your life today? Your own manipulations, your own victories, your own strength, your own pleasures, If that's what your capacity for being enriched is, you've got a lot. Who doesn't even learn from this event? And the next time we find him is in chapter 19, verse 1, sitting in the gate of Sodom. But you know what? Because Abraham refuses to find enrichment from the things in this world, the next time we see him is in chapter 15, verse 1. And this time we don't have a king of Sodom. We don't even have a king of Salem coming to him. It says, the Lord came, the word of the Lord came to Abraham in a vision. And said, Abram, I'm your shield. Your reward is more than you can imagine. We're strangers, folks, and we're pilgrims in this land, but we're strangers and pilgrims who are waiting actively for God to give us his blessing. Active engagement means cultivating strategic relationships that God has brought us in context with. Active engagement looks like preparing for risky involvement, something more than you would imagine. It's going to cost a lot, and you've got to be prepared. And active engagement looks like discerning spiritual enrichment. What are you surrounding yourself with, and what are you enriching yourself by? Are you enriching yourself by God working on your behalf to show you how big he is?